You're listening to DraftKings Network.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Now's a good time to remember where the story of tequila started. In 1795, the first tequila distillery was opened by the Cuervo family. And 229 years later, Cuervo is still going strong. Family-owned from the start, same family, same land. Now's a good time to enjoy Cuervo, the tequila that invented tequila. Go to Cuervo.com to shop tequila or visit a store near you. Cuervo, now's a good time.
Trademarks owned by Becle, SAB, the CV. Copyright 2024, Proximo. Jersey City, New Jersey. Please drink responsibly.
This is the Dan Le Batard Show with the Stugatz Podcast.
So one of the mistakes that we have made around here for many years is sometimes because we are a lot of men around here talking about issues, I've had some blind spots sometimes when it comes to the gender stuff that we wanted to correct at ESPN and feel like we did a decent job of correcting with Mina and Sarah and Katie and Elle and a lot of different voices here to call us out when we sound a little male privileged. And so I wanted to have on Diana Moskowitz, excuse me if I've stumbled over your name there. She's co-owner and investigations editor for Defector Media and did a lot of reporting about domestic abuse at the Miami Herald that will inform the conversation we're about to have about Chad Wheeler. She's written for Defector about this, and you should go check out what it is that she has written because it is strong and it might offer you a different perspective. But I also wanted to talk to her about her past years for the Miami Herald covering some of this stuff and how complicated it is, how difficult it is to talk about, to cover well, to adjudicate, to legislate. So she is on with us, and thank you for being on with us, Diana. So you wrote this article, and what would you want the audience to know about what it is that you have written, that the fear doesn't end when the abuse does?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. I think when I wrote that, I really wanted to come from a place, especially with Chad Wheeler, where I knew that this was a story that would probably, you know, drop off of everyone's media consumption very soon. He was a backup lineman for the Seattle Seahawks. Admittedly, I had never heard of him before this happened. And also just factoring in that there was a pretty swift arrest. He was already charged. The Seahawks made clear they were not going to re-sign him, that this was something that would, yeah, just pretty soon drop off everyone's websites, headlines, Twitter feeds. And I, especially when I was reading what his ex-girlfriend, who he, according to multiple police reports, 911 calls, violently attacked, as Aaliyah Taylor told the courtroom, she said she was still very afraid and very scared despite everything that had been done and put in place for her. And I was just thinking how, and this happens with stories all the time, you know, we know as journalists, as reporters, that just because we leave the scene, we leave the story, the people to whom the tragedy has happened, they keep living with it, you know, for the rest of their lives. And in this case, I was just really thinking about that in a couple of weeks, this is going to drop off and we'll move on. And I'm part of the journalism machine. That includes me moving on. But I just wanted to take a moment to think about this is something that she will live with for the rest of her life. This happened to her. And even in the immediate, she said she was, you know, very afraid and very scared and did not feel safe. And that is something that she is probably still feeling today and will feel tomorrow and continue to feel as this moves through the legal system, which can take a really long time.
So the details that are most horrifying to you when we cover some of the details, because Chad Wheeler is being portrayed correctly as a monster who is something between mentally ill and evil because he could do this to someone that he allegedly loves. So the details of this, how does she overcome that kind of beating and the idea that she would walk across the room beaten by a man three times her size and he would coldly be eating and wonder aloud, how are you still alive? Oh, you're still alive.
I mean, how does she overcome that? That's probably something that even she is working on right now. I mean, I would say that in the moment, she's just trying to save her life. Clearly, she's literally just trying to save her life. And then, you know, afterwards, she's asking for her dad and her family, and she's taken to a hospital. And, you know, I would say from then, that's probably something, and I don't want to, can't speak for her, but I would just say from what I know and I've seen and I've read so far that it's something she's still working on, you know, like a feeling of safety is not something that you just like snap your fingers and then and then you get it again, right? Like that is something that she will have to and will continue to work on. And at least it does seem her family is there and, you know, she has support around her, which is huge. We could say that, you know, well, Wheeler's out on bail, which is part of what she was talking about with feeling unsafe. But yeah, it's something that she will have to continue to work on, and those around her will have to continue to work on. She did give a sit-down interview with CBS this morning, yesterday. And she said that she hoped telling her story would help other people who have gone through or, you know, in intimate partner violence. She hoped it would help them. And so hopefully that was also very helpful for her. But yeah, it's going to be a daily question for her for a really long time.
What else did she say in that interview that was interesting? Is she someone who loves Chad Wheeler still? Is it someone that she is going to have to hide from? Is Chad Wheeler a monster? Is he mentally ill? What is happening there that she was able to shed light on?
What she talked about, she talked a lot about what happened that night, which she was very detailed when she talked to police. The police were very detailed when they were filing their reports of that night. So for folks who have read some of that reporting, if they watch that interview, will actually feel pretty similar to what they already know. She was described as Wheeler's ex-girlfriend. So I will use that term. By all accounts, appears that they have broken up. And one thing she did say was she was asked in the police reports, and Wheeler later confirmed that he has bipolar disorder. In one of the police reports, Aaliyah Taylor said that Chad Wheeler had stopped taking his medication. It doesn't say for how long. And she did tell police and again did say that he appeared to be having some type of break. He went to a dark place, was not behaving like his normal self. What she did say in that interview that really stuck out to me was she was asked, do you feel that mental illness, mental health was a factor in what happened to you? And Aaliyah Taylor said, I don't know. Because on the one hand, she knows about this history. She's pointing it out to police, right? On the other hand, she noted that Chad was acting differently with the police than he was with her. That he even, there was a moment where she believed he like either called or FaceTimed someone and he sounded different, right? He wasn't behaving this way with everyone. So at one point, you know, is it a factor? And at one point, is it not? And she said, I don't know. She said, I don't know. And I think it's very brave of her to give an honest answer because to some extent, how could she know? She is just one person. And in that moment, she's just trying to save her life, not do a mental exam. So I think she deserves a lot of credit for giving a very brave and honest answer, even if admittedly that just even makes it more complicated, right? Even the woman who is being attacked says, I don't know how much this was a factor. I can't say for certain. And it would not make much sense to ignore this, right? Pretend that his diagnosis wasn't there. How much could we put all of it on that, some of it on that, right? And again, even Aaliyah Taylor doesn't know. And I should say I'm using her name because she has used her name in the interview. So she wants that out there.
It sounds like somewhere within this, you're trying to find ways, after a long time covering this stuff, Diana, where you're trying to find ways to extend compassion to the person in this equation who is not a victim. Although it sounds like you can sort of wonder uncomfortably whether he's a victim of mental illness that made him do something that is a psychotic break. It seems like a reach. I don't know that a lot of people are going to want to see those photos and see anyone extending this person anything in the way of understanding, empathy, or compassion.
Yeah, I mean, look, I get it. The whole reason we know this story is because Aaliyah Taylor's story went viral because of these photos. And I know from my own writing in the past, that's what happens with photos. They go viral and they grab people's attention and they make people believe. And that can be very powerful. And you know, also there can be some cynicism about that, right? Oh, you're only a victim if you get photos, right? You're only a victim if you have a bloody face, right? So first of all, I should just like to mention that we're talking about intimate partner violence. It exists on a spectrum, and it includes emotional violence. It includes, you know, manipulation, power, and control, right? You do not have to have a bloody face to be a victim. But in a case where there are these very, very graphic photos, you know, for me, I try to think of it and come from a place of always thinking, what would make survivors feel safer? Because that's always what people ask. When I used to be a reporter at the Miami Herald, and a couple of things I remember, you know, one was how often I wrote about women who were murdered by men that they knew, and often men that they loved. And I would write those stories over and over, and sometimes was even told they're not news because it happens all the time and it's always the same thing. And also when I would do stories where someone had survived, and you will still hear this today, and you even hear it in Aaliyah Taylor, where they're saying, I just want to feel safe. What can I do to be safe? What can be done so this doesn't happen again? And in some ways, I find it very noble that so often people are just saying, I don't want this to happen to someone else. That's what I want. I want it to stop with me, for me to be the final one. Great. That's great. We can all get behind that, right? And yet, there is nothing in the way we've currently construed our response, especially with a criminal justice aspect. And I'd argue, even with the NFL's response, which is in many ways, it's headed by a prosecutor. It's basically a recreation of the criminal justice system, but just without jail or prison. It doesn't work. Because if it worked, I wouldn't have been writing those stories over and over. I would still not be writing those stories. It'd be a great way to get out of part of my job, right? Guys, great. There are other things I can report on. Great. And so for me, because I'm thinking, okay, what do survivors want? And they want this violence to end. And I know for the violence to end, then we have to really take a deeper look at how it happens and why it happens and how it's perpetuated. And what does it take to stop that? And at some point it's going to involve the compassion first of all, again, acknowledge that our system isn't working, and then to figure out what might. And so often that involves compassion, because it's saying, okay, who has caused the violence and how can we change them? And then often you realize, and this is a line of thinking that comes up a lot in prison abolition work, which is that it's really about changing ourselves and our community, right? That often, you know, a huge part of intimate partner violence, you know, when you look at the factors that often lead to it, it's things like knowing the community will let you get away with it. It's things like unemployment, job instability. When the pandemic happened, there was a ton of reporting. Calls to domestic violence hotlines are going to go up. And they did, because a global pandemic with massive layoffs, economic insecurity, right there, we know it's a risk factor, right? On top of people having to be home from work all the time. So there's no escape if you're a person in an abusive relationship. You're now home all the time. Again, if you look at the list of risk factors, a lot of them are things that are actually about like our communities and ourselves and how we treat each other and our neighbors, you know. And so for me, that's really like where my compassion comes from. I just don't want this to happen again. I just want to create a world where Chad Wheeler won't do this again. And I can tell Aaliyah Taylor, this won't happen again to you. You're safe. And I know that doesn't come from throwing him in, you know, in prison or in jail. That's a short-term solution, temporary solution. But that, again, especially with our prison and jails, not known for great treatment of the mentally ill. So I know that's not going to be the long-term turnaround, you know, that he needs. And so then it's, okay, what is that? And it requires you to not see a person as a monster, right? Because when you see a person as a monster, you just want to throw them away. And I understand that instinct. It's what I used to have, and it's taken a lot of years and time and reading and studying to move away from that. I think it's a viewpoint our society encourages. It's one, something like prison and jails encourage, right? Just go over there. I don't want to think about you, right? It's a lot harder to think about, was I part of the problem because I'm sending out signals that it's cool to do that, bro, you know? That's a lot harder. I won't lie. I don't even like thinking about that, you know? I don't think any of us has been perfect on that issue for sure. But yeah, that's where it comes from. And that's always my pitch to people is like throwing away people just doesn't work. If it had been working, I wouldn't have, part of me thinks if it had been working, I wouldn't have been writing all those stories at the Herald, right? And writing them over and over for years and years and years. Cause it doesn't work. It doesn't freaking work.
Your reporting on this over the years, what you're saying is that basically when you say the NFL is just doing what the criminal justice system does, they have discarded the mental illness. It caused them a problem they may not have if he was a very valuable player as opposed to a totally disposable one. But they've just done what is the easiest thing to do, right? This is not battling domestic abuse. This is not tackling mental illness. This is simply banishing the guy who made you look bad.
Yeah, basically. And look, especially in a case like this, I mean, part of me wants to be clear, I'm not advocating for the Seahawks to re-sign him. He was basically in a situation where they were going to have to re-sign him and they're choosing not to re-sign him, right? And I can't say that in that situation, I would tell them to do something differently, right? I mean, you know, at the end of the day, we live in America and people were outraged. And it shouldn't, it can't be on the NFL or on teams to fix these people either, right? Like they're corporations, it's a business, right? And I think we get really lost in all these leagues because they're like these billion-dollar corporations. They love to remind us they're global enterprises. They're so international. They're healing the world with sports. And we can forget that they're just businesses and it's an employer. And that means there's real limitations to what they can accomplish. I don't think any of these leagues are going to be the ones to suddenly figure out how to perfectly handle domestic violence when no one else in the world has, right? I think it was very audacious for them to say they're going to get it right when this is an issue that countries and leaders and brilliant minds across the world struggle to get right. You know, you're telling me great legal thinkers, can have all these complex conversations and sometimes I don't know the answer, but the NFL and the NBA and MLB, they know the answer. Like, no, they don't. And they're corporations. They're not the government. They're not a church. They're not a program. I always like to tell people that, you know, let's know what they're not. There is only so much they can do. I think their value, and I'm leaning a lot on the thoughts here of Professor Beth Ritchie, who's a very brilliant, brilliant mind in the area of domestic violence and prison abolition, where she talks about community. And it's helpful to think of, you know, the NFL is a community, right? And so how could it be helpful in building a community where this is unacceptable? And also there will be times, and you could argue that this is one where someone is so dangerous, where you might have to say, you can't be in this community for a while because what you did is so dangerous and so awful. You can't be a part of this community for a while. And you could argue that again, with Chad Wheeler, that's arguably like what should happen and really what is happening.
Diana, it must be just generally exasperating, frustrating to you as a professional to be sort of trapped inside this prison where you're writing about the same thing over decades and decades and decades and nobody's got, or years and years. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to make you older than you actually are.
Decades and decades.
But you're writing about the same thing and you're writing about no better results and you're writing about no system that is in any way qualified to do all of the nuance that this requires. That you're basically throwing your hands up in the air because nothing fixes this. It's just a recreation of the same problem. And then we expel the people. There's no rehabbing of the people. They're mentally ill monsters. We're the media. We judge them as monsters. And then we walk away to the next story like this that looks like this.
You know, people ask me that sometimes. And I have to admit, I always feel like it doesn't feel like a trap to me. And maybe this is a testament to my not great career planning, right? In some ways, I feel like, you know, there's a part of the journalism machine that wants me to move on. Like, girl, don't you want to do other stuff, right? I can feel that when I talk to people. But I always feel like what that is saying to me is that this is not important. And God, this sounds so cheesy, but like deep in like my heart, I feel like I just really fucking care so much. I forgot to ask if I could curse beforehand. My apologies. But I really like, I fucking care. And I know a lot of other people do because, you know, I always throw out the CDC statistics and I believe it's something where it's like, one out of every four women and nearly one out of every 10 men will experience intimate partner violence in our lifetimes. I mean, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There's eight of us here. So like we're getting close to that 10 to 11 guys already. And which means if we add a couple more people to this call, one of y'all is experiencing intimate partner violence in your lifetime. Right. And so it just feels so urgent to me. It really does. Cause it's impacted my life. It's impacted the life of people I know. It feels, and look, there's so much that's urgent in this country, right? This is not the only thing, but it just feels so important to me. And so to me, you know, just like the little assignment editor in my heart always feels like this is news and you'll never convince me otherwise, just, you know, to get down to it. Like you will, and sometimes it just feels important to me, like to say that, like this is news, right? And because I think sometimes that's half the battle still on this issue, seriously. It's just be like, no, this is news. And no one likes to think about it because it's happening every day, but it is news and we need to talk about it. I know something that came up with Aaliyah Taylor, because Aaliyah Taylor is Black and a lot of people were talking about how there's also a way to view this as a story about violence toward Black women. We know that Black women disproportionately suffer from intimate partner violence. So, you know, the statistics would say that it is still less likely to happen to me as a white woman than if I was Black. Especially if you are a Black woman, your intimate partner violence is more likely to be a lot more fatal for it to end in your murder. And so for some women in this country, this is so vital. It's their lives on the line. And it still feels important to me, you know. And, you know, if there's anything that still helps me along, it has been in my years every now and then, you know, I'll get an email from someone at the old shop or now at Defector saying, you know, I used to not know how to talk about this with other men. And now I try to because I read your work. Or they'll say, there was a situation where I normally wouldn't have done anything and I tried to intervene or I did call the police because things seemed very dangerous. And that was because of you. And I know that's not like big systemic change.
No, but it makes you feel less hopeless. It makes you feel less hopeless. I understand that part of it. Yes.
I think that's part of it. You know, I don't, because I know there's not there's no magical law the government can pass to just suddenly fix this, right? I mean, we tried that with the Violence Against Women Act and it did not end up helping nearly as much as people thought it would, right? We thought we would just criminalize it. 1992, fix everything. Totally did not work. And so for me, just knowing that there are individuals out there who are turning a corner, who can talk about it, who are feeling better equipped to recognize it, to offer aid, to offer help, that feels super important to me. And so long as I get one of those emails, I'll keep doing it.
Diana, thank you for being on with us again. Co-owner, Investigations Editor, Defector Media. She's been covering this stuff for a while. Not decades and decades, just years and years. I'm sorry about that. Diana, thank you for being on with us.
Thank you for having me.